Well, thank you so much, Aaron, for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. You're my 81st guest. How are you today, Aaron?
I'm doing great. I had a very restful Labor Day weekend and excited to be on here with you. And I appreciate you extending the invitation. You joined quite the illustrious guest list you've had. And I'm just touched you thought about me in the same echelon as all the great folks you've talked to so far.
Well, I really appreciate that, Aaron, and it's a pleasure having you on today. I just released episode 75 with CNN senior legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. So just moving right along with my illustrious group of guests, and each one has an amazing story to tell about relationship building, the team environment, and what it has meant for him or her in his or her professional career. And I would love to ask you that question today. And before we begin, I just want to, for my audience at home, you were the deputy director of speechwriting for Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and then you moved to director of speechwriting for Speaker Pelosi. You were communications director and chief speechwriter for Nancy Pelosi when her title moved to Speaker Emerita. And you also were part of the Democratic National Convention Committee Writers Room, looking forward to hearing more about that. And when former Vice President Harris was running for president last year, you were a speechwriter for Governor and First Lady Walz, started out as surrogate speechwriter and then moved up to speechwriter for the Walzes. And currently you are the senior speechwriter at the organization called Fenway. So speechwriting is the operative word, correct? I mean, you have prided yourself on working on campaigns or working on Capitol Hill, whether working for the Walzes or former U.S. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who now is Speaker Emerita, Nancy Pelosi. So my question to you, Aaron, is that when you think of relationship building in a team environment, what does relationship building mean to you? And what has it meant for your professional career?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is absolutely everything. And I know I'm not the first political guest that you've had on the podcast, so I'm sure you've heard this before, but relationships are the currency that Washington, D.C. and the entire political world operate on, much like I imagine every other profession, folks that you've talked to so far. But I can tell you a little bit about my story and how the relationships played into that. So about this time, 5 years ago, in the summer of 2020, I was stuck at home. I was a press assistant for Senator Brian Schatz on the Senate side of Capitol Hill, and loved him, loved the job, but started thinking a little bit more existentially about what I wanted my career to be and to look like. So what did I do? I picked up the phone and I started calling anyone and everyone who had ever touched the field of speech writing. And that goes from folks that I knew personally, just from having some sort of relationships around town. I also reached out on LinkedIn and cold DM'd people. I asked friends to connect me with other friends, start having these conversations, and start building a relationship of folks in speech writing, just to figure out, you know, what the field is and what it could be and how people do speech writing and the stories they have from their on-the-job training in the field. And yeah, that's what really got me hooked on speech writing. And in the course of those conversations, I got connected with a guy named Ben Krause. Currently, he's the CEO of Fenway. He was CEO at the time. And he came to me with an interesting proposition. He liked me from our initial call, and he asked me if I wanted to do some surrogate volunteer speech writing for the Biden-Harris campaign. This is the summer of 2020. And me, having no experience in speech writing and just trying to break in desperately, said, sure, you know, I have time, you know, before 8 a.m. and after 8 p.m. and time on the weekends that I can volunteer and contribute to do some writing for the campaign. And working with him over the course of those next 5, 6, 7 months, ended up doing a lot of real writing for campaign surrogates that were going out and speaking on behalf of then Vice President Biden and Senator Harris as they were running for president. As you may have heard, we won that race. So coming out of that election had me thinking, okay, this was a passion project, a side project. How do I turn it into my full career? How do I finally become a speechwriter? And that's when Ben reached out. I guess over the course of the campaign, I had proven myself in some way, or he saw something in me, and I'll always be grateful to him for that. But he reached out and said that he had heard that Speaker Pelosi was going to need a new deputy speechwriter. And what did I have any interest in applying for that job? I said, absolutely. So he connected me to the chief speechwriter at the time. What I did not know is that they were dating, and then a couple of years later, I'd be going to their wedding. But the speechwriting world is a really small world, so it just goes to show the value of relationships there. But anyway, he plugged me in with her, And within a few weeks, she hired and brought me on. And that's how I started as deputy speechwriter for Speaker Pelosi. And then about a year into that, there was this big shakeup within our comms operation. So the chief speechwriter got promoted to deputy communications director. And me, just by virtue of being in the hot seat, got elevated up to chief speechwriter. So I was chief speechwriter for the final year of her term as speaker. And I think that transition is worth talking about if we want to come back to that at some point, because relationships, especially in that speaker's office, did play such a huge role in the work I was doing there. But just to continue the brief hit of the story, after the speaker decided to step down from leadership but retain her seat in the House, we went from a staff of about 80 people to about 8 people. So me being the highest man up on the ladder that was willing to stay and could afford to stay, because a lot of other folks went on to much more lucrative careers after their long public service. They were able to keep me on as communications director for Speaker Emerita and also continued to do her speech writing. And then who would come knocking about 2 years later would be Ben again. And Fenway had the contract to do speech writing for the first, the Biden campaign, then it became the Harris campaign. And they were looking to bring on me as a contractor to help out essentially with that campaign work. And by twists and turns, we went from one ticket to another. And when the Walls joined, they needed speechwriting assistance. So there I was, right place, right time, and got to work with Governor and Mrs. Walls for the final 91 days of the election, and got to travel on the road with Mrs. Walls. And we could talk about that later on as well before the finally election day. And then Ben came knocking once again and offered me a full-time job with Fenway after my, I guess, year-long audition. And that's where I am today. So the moral of the story is relationships do have the power to dictate the course of your entire career. And my philosophy has always been prioritizing quality of those relationships over quantity. There are a lot of folks that think the way to win in DC is just to go to all the networking events and, to have cocktails with everybody and talk to everyone once and build, just a list of names you can call at any time. And in my experience, it's been more of building the deep relationships that you can lean on again and again with key folks that you have a genuine connection with. That's been my path to success.
Yeah, that's an amazing story and so incredible that you were plugged in at the right time through your friendship with Ben. And when you think about having worked for Speaker Pelosi and getting to interact with Vice President Harris and Governor Walz and his wife, First Lady of Minnesota, Gwen Walz, what are qualities and characteristics, because you speak about relationships, quality over quantity. And I truly feel that way too. When I had started my career, I was an intern at the time for a U.S. Congressman from North Carolina on Capitol Hill, Brad Miller from the old 13th District. And I just remember knocking on doors, looking for an internship, and just knowing the power of your presence and persistence and really pushing forward to be seen and be heard and be listened to and to, right place, right time. I walked in the right office and they were looking for an intern. And, my life took a different direction because then I worked for NBC Universal, NBC News Bureau in DC, and then I worked at ESPN. And then, my life has become full circle where I came back into journalism and politics and talking about public policy, talking about the financial news of the day and being interviewed on networks and local and digital news media outlets. And so listening to your story is quite fascinating because, you could see the trajectory within the political realm for you, and you look back 5 years ago and see where you are now, and it's truly remarkable the career success that you've had. And so going back to my question of with Speaker Pelosi, the Walzes, Vice President Harris, who was running her campaign last year, and choosing Governor Walz as her, VP pick, what are qualities and characteristics that you value in all of these individuals in the Democratic Party that you feel are what makes them great model citizens and public servants, where you've looked to emulate them as you look to shape your own career?
Yeah, and just a clarifying thought here. I've never interacted with Vice President Harris. I'm sure she's wonderful, but that was always above my pay grade. So I'll limit my answer to it working directly with the speaker and also with the Walzes. And I think that what I look for when trying to determine, my next place to work, and this goes for the principal, whoever's name's on the door, but also the team, the people that you're working with every day, is, and this is going to sound cheesy or maybe a little cliche, but I think it's true that you want to have that shared foundation of values with folks. And by that, I don't mean you must align on every specific policy point. I mean, I've worked for Senator Schatz, who's considered very progressive, from Hawaii to Speaker Pelosi, who had to hold the whole wide coalition together, to the Wallses, the Midwestern common sense sensibility really runs the gamut. And that's even true for a lot of the clients that I work for today at Fenway, run the gamut in terms of their priorities, the policies. Some are corporate, some are political. It really runs the spectrum. But what I look for is a uniting ethos of, I mean, to put it bluntly, good people doing good things, right? And there's a lot of ways to define that, but you really want to know that they're in it for the right reasons. They have a good head on their shoulders. They're smart, they're strategic, they're kind. That's sort of what I've always looked for in an environment that I want to join. And then thinking about building those relationships, right? When you're building a professional relationship, in my mind, I've always thought the formula is a little is quite simple. It's demonstrating your value, and that means basically your talent and trust in you, right? And that is how you build, that sort of relationship, and it goes both ways. But you want to show them that there's something about you that is unique that you bring to the table. You add, something to the team that they're building, but also that they can rely on you, that you're dependable, right? That you're communicative. That's the trust. So in these environments, especially in politics, when things are fast moving and always changing, having a team that operates at that level, right, where everyone trusts each other, everyone is talented in their own way, is the best way that I found to find success. And to bring it back to your question, that's on much grander scale. The leaders that I want to work for demonstrate that as well, right? They're not just all talk. They have a record of executing and getting things done. That's the trust, and they're talented, right? As speechwriters, the words on the page can only go so far, right? The best sort of speechwriting relationships are collaborative. And I think this is true. A lot of my colleagues today were speechwriters in the White House with President Obama. And what they will always say is that President Obama is one of the most talented writers, probably in political history. I mean, at least since Lincoln. But when you are in charge of so much, your time is so limited. So having that relationship of trust with a talented speechwriter is a way to take some of that edge off, right? And to get to work in that collaborative dynamic, where you can still produce products that, you're proud to put your name on. So that's been the best speechwriting experiences for me. I mean, especially with someone like Speaker Pelosi, who was around for 34 years before I got to the office. And no, she always knows what she wants to say. She is so adept at creating clever, pithy ways to say it. And that complements the skill set that I bring, which is, okay, stringing out the argument, right? Building it out, fleshing it out in full, rather than just sound bites. We're telling a full story, right? We're trying to persuade and try to bring people from point A to point B, bring them with you. So we complement each other in that sort of dynamic. And the same is true for Mrs. Walls, who just has a wealth of fun anecdotes and stories from, her time on the political scene in Minnesota, but also, living a very normal life. I mean, she's a teacher, right? A longtime teacher who's was in Minnesota for almost her entire life, packed up to move to Nebraska, where she met Governor Walz, and then they moved back to Mankato together. She's a military spouse. She's raised two young kids. It just has a wealth of fascinating stories to share. And what I could help bring to the table with her was finding effective ways to tell them and also hook them to the political values that we were trying to communicate as a part of that campaign. So that complementary nature is just so fundamental to speechwriting. It really is a collaborative partnership.
Yeah, I love how you use the terminology of collaboration, being collaborative, collaborating on these speeches, because your relationship building with these political figures, these titans in the Democratic Party whose careers have stood the test of time and generationally they've had impacts on DC politics as well as just the trajectory of human history, right? Here in this country, as Americans, I mean, the bills that they've backed, the people they've supported along the way, meaning their constituents, having the best interests of their constituents is why they do the job, is why they are have been highly successful, and they've been the mainstays in politics, but also they've been beacons of light, in terms of in the Democratic Party, because whether it's, President Joe Biden, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, whether it's Vice President Harris, you talk about the Wallses, and yes, Governor Walz has his military background. First Lady Walz, you talk about her being a teacher, an educator. Same goes for, First Lady or former First Lady Jill Biden, educator, a teacher, someone who is very similar in that regard to First Lady Walz of Minnesota. And you talk about them having military backgrounds, and President Biden's son Beau, who tragically passed away, had served in the military for our armed forces. So I love that there's a lot of synergies in terms of their backgrounds. But going back to speech writing, did you ever feel that when you were collaborating on these speeches in the beginning of the speech writing process, when you were getting into these very important positions and taking an active, integral role in the successful nature of these speeches before delivery, did you feel like you had, complete ownership, or it didn't start out that way where there was some ownership on your part, but having to work for Nancy Pelosi and then having to, help, Gwen Walz and Governor Walz with their speech writing, how much did they really insert themselves in these speeches? And as you talk about really delivering or creating a message and then delivering that message, talk me about, just the compare and contrast of working on speeches with both Pelosi and the Walzes.
I guess to start, I want to reframe, I guess, the way that question was asked, because I don't think ownership is the right way to think about it. In you ask any speechwriter, the ownership of the speeches are completely the principals, right? We think of ourselves as an extension of their brains and their pens. They just simply don't have the time to sit down and do the heavy lifting. But the words, the stories, the ideas, the arguments, they're all theirs. And I say that completely earnestly because a lot of the time, what we are doing, what we have the time and space to do as speechwriters, and often the principals don't, is to do that research, to do the careful listening, to go find those nuggets in speeches they've given before, or op-eds they've written, or even in a meeting that where they say something offhand, but it's really artful, right? And those become sort of the seeds from which a speech can sprout. So the speeches are entirely theirs, and I don't think any speechwriter worth their salt would tell you otherwise. But where we add value is doing that heavy lifting and saving them time in that process. So just to state that at the outset, I think it depends on the type of speech that you're writing. Sometimes with a smaller speech, a shorter speech, the speaker would go out and join a press conference for climate action on, the Capitol. They call it the House Triangle, which is that spot just off the east side of the Capitol. Something like that, where it's 2 or 3 minutes. It doesn't necessarily involve a lot of back and forth with the speaker, mostly because she's given a million of those and she ultimately knows what she's going to say. And it's just for me to make sure the right names and acknowledgments and the key messages are on a card, so she knows, where she can and should go in the course of those remarks. But she's, like we were talking about, talented before. She was gifted enough to be able to go off script and handle those pretty solo. Then there's something a bit longer and more involved, say a floor speech or a commencement address or a keynote or the final speech she gave on the House floor, not the final, but the major one announcing that she was stepping down from speaker, but staying in the Congress. Those sorts of speeches require a lot more back and forth. So typically what you'll do is do a beginning sort of brain dump, brainstorm kind of meeting with the principal, where you'll share, here's where the speech is, here's who you're talking to, here's the size of the crowd, here's the vibe of the event, here's the setting, here's the purpose, if there's a tagline or theme for the evening, just give them all the information they need to start formulating what they want to say. And then you just sit back and let them talk, right? Like sometimes they'll recount stories from, if it's a veterans event, right? Like her trips to Normandy or like other visits with veterans. There was one speech that we did with the speaker that was the christening of, I believe it was the Robert F. Kennedy, a ship, a naval ship that was going to be in San Francisco. So got to hear some of her reflections on the Kennedys, the good ones, not the mess we have to deal with today. So you sort of pull out some themes and elements of the speeches from an initial meeting. Then you'd go back and start a draft. And no draft is perfect. You almost never nail it on the first draft. But that's why you have this iterative process of back and forth where you'll sit down with your principal again and you show them the speech. Maybe it's just an outline, maybe it's a full draft, and they'll give you higher level thoughts on structure, on direction, on themes, on arguments, on, the pieces. Are they in the right order? And then slowly over time, you'll refine again and again and again, iterate and iterate into the point where you're arguing over commas or period placements, right? Or paragraph breaks. And it's that constant back and forth that turns the speech from that blank page, just blue sky brainstorming into a final product that A says what, your principal wants it to say, right? The message is clear. But B says it in a way that the principal is comfortable with, right? Anyone can write a brilliant speech, like artistically, poetically fantastic. It is a different challenge to write a speech that is perfect for an individual, right? And getting to learn their voice and the way they're comfortable saying things, oftentimes that leads for a more effective speech, a speech that can be delivered better than something that may be brilliant prose, but is not going to yield the best performance from the person who's delivering it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense because, as you pointed out, you can write a perfect speech with, colorful language that provides a lot of imagery. A lot of times, politicians, they make speeches for cause and effect, or they like to draw comparisons. And, over the years, you watch some of these speeches, and there's a lot of emotion to them at times. I believe that's where they get the expression that you hear on the Hill, political theater. But I believe that in your case, I mean, these are speeches that are truly genuine. I mean, they're coming from people like Speaker Nancy Pelosi. They're coming from Vice President Harris, Joe Biden. Listen to many speeches, over the years, just from afar, right? You can, watch them on YouTube, you watch them on live TV, Chuck Schumer. Bernie Sanders, all of them have different ways of, executing, talking points and delivering those points to whomever they're speaking with. They're able to tailor their remarks based upon the audience who's listening to them. And President Obama, yes, in my opinion, the greatest speaker in terms of, so eloquent, so it's direct in a sense. It's a conversation, but it's very purposeful, his remarks. It's very intentional. He measures every word. That's his legal training too, as a former constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago. I mean, and someone who is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He is somebody who, yes, I believe is the greatest, speech maker, somebody who's probably the greatest since Lincoln, right? And I truly believe that, not to compare parties from Democrat to Republican, but Republicans, they have their own style of speeches. I always feel like the Democrats have a unique way of just because it's a party where it's supposed to be like a party for all, right? The inclusion, the various walks of life who identify themselves with the Democratic Party. So they're speaking to a vast population from all corners of the country. And if they're making speeches for a global audience, I mean, ever the more reason to make sure that your message, although is, let's say, tailored to various groups of people, the message has to be on point where it applies to everyone, where everybody is able to interpret the speech in a way that makes sense for them. And there are constituents within constituents, right? I mean, you can have, if a politician, right, is, as you know, could be making a speech to a certain group of people or an organization, or within an organization, there are different like subgroups or whomever, where they want to be able to talk about how that speech impacts them and what it means for themselves, their families, and wherever and whatever the speech is being discussed. So my question to you is that when you are collaborating on these speeches, do you ever feel that the final product that you put out, are there ever times where after that speech is made, you feel like, well, we could have wrote it a little bit differently, or the points that we were going to emphasize maybe didn't get across? Or, I mean, is there any like Monday morning quarterbacking, so to speak, when it comes to delivering speeches?
Oh, all the time. I mean, almost every speech that I've worked on and then seen delivered, I'll go back and be critical and say, I wish I had done this differently, or I wish I'd used that story or that metaphor. And I think that's what makes this craft so awesome, so special, because you put 10 speechwriters in a room and give them the same task, and they'll produce 10 very different speeches. And that doesn't make one better than another, right? Or more effective or more compelling than another. There are just so many different ways to do this craft. And what usually the puzzle piece that you have to fit together is, you know, which writer's way of thinking and approaching fits best with the principle, right? And how they work. Usually that's the dynamic that you have to build, to your point about relationship building. But in terms of the speech itself, yeah, like I'll see stuff that other people write and think, damn, why didn't I think of that or do it that way? And you, same thing when you're watching your own speech, you know, I wish I had gotten that instead of that. Or you see a principal trip up on a word, it's, you know, you make a mental note, you know, next time, you know, you don't say it this way, you say it that way. I think that's human nature. And I think that's part of any sort of creative process, is at some point you have to know when to stop, right? Like, you could iterate on a speech forever and ever and ever, but the thing with politics is that everything happens so quickly, and if you don't get something out the door, you're behind. So typically in the speaker's office, also on the campaign trail, I was writing day to day. So I was producing tomorrow's speeches, you know, by 8 p.m. the night before, because you were just in that kind of crunch with time to be able to produce that much content, that oftentimes you don't get to do the Monday morning quarterbacking until, you know, it's already out the door, because you just don't have that kind of time. And I think that's what distinguishes speech writing in a political, governmental kind of context from a lot of other creative sort of writing, right? Thinking like your novelists or your screenwriters, or, you know, your literary critiquers, right? Your book writers, you know, it is about creating great speeches, yes, but there's a quality threshold you have to hit, and then you have to move on, because the volume is not going to stop, right? Politics never stops. Great people like Speaker Pelosi, with just an endless motor, will never stop. And there's a limit to how much you can really, you know, allow yourself to get stuck down the rabbit hole of, I wish I'd sent things this way, I wish I'd done them another way, right? Just fix it and get better for the next speech. And over time, that dynamic with a principal grows and evolves, and you improve as a speechwriter over time. I think, like, it took me 6 to 8 months in the speaker's office just to get a handle on her voice. And I know that because the chief speechwriter, when I was the deputy, would edit everything that I was doing, and she would always send back tracked edits because she was the best manager ever. And I could see that my initial products were getting tons of red marks, right? And then over time, that lessens, because you're growing into the voice, you're improving as a writer, you're getting a better handle of the environment, right, in the context of every speech and the audiences you're writing for, because all that is dependent on who you're working for and what they're trying to accomplish. So it's just one of those jobs where over time you expect that it's a bit slower of a start, but you will just get better and better and better as that dynamic improves.
Yeah, that's greatly explained. I mean, that's really well said, because it's all about less is more too. You don't want a speech to go too long. You also don't want a, you know, short and concise speech. I mean, brevity is important, but there's a time and place for brevity. I mean, speeches need to be, the ideas need to be fleshed out. I mean, the story has to be where people can follow and really come away from that speech remembering 3 to 5 really solid bullet points of, you know, action. I mean, that's what speeches are. They're a plan of action, or plans of action. You know, what do the listeners take from the speeches, and how do they apply that, okay, to where they live? And it's not supposed to be the end all be all, like you have the speech or give the speech rather. And then, yes, to your point, we live in a 24 hours a day, 7 days a week news cycle. And so you're on to the next speech. You know, you talk about getting a speech completed at 8 p.m. or by 8 p.m., you know, the night before the speech is supposed to be delivered. And if you look at throughout history, I mean, if you look at during President Kennedy's time or even FDR's time, I mean, even the Clinton years, which was just, you know, 30 years ago, I mean, technology has really transformed politics. But from a speech writing standpoint, you have to deliver these speeches. First and foremost, you have to write them based upon a collaborative effort with the principal and, you know, all the other team players who are reviewing these speeches and making sure like everything is what needs to be in there and what needs to be said, and that you need to write them in a certain way that gets the most maximum impact, and that it's a certain length and it tells that story, it lets that story breathe. And again, I mentioned plan of action, you know, action points, 3 to 5, I would say. I have a journalism and mass communication background, so I have an appreciation for, you know, this is like a subgroup of journalists, right? This is not journalism, but it is a form of journalism in the speech writing world, right? Because it's still a speech. It's still a press release, if you will, or some speeches that are not given verbally, they could be condensed to more of like a presser or a press release, right? And, you know, I just find that very fascinating because at one time I was interested in looking at speech writing, and with my journalism background and my interest in public policy and, you know, geopolitics and, you know, what's going on from a domestic standpoint, a foreign policy standpoint. So it is interesting to me to hear about how you consider yourself to be an extension of, you know, what the principals, whether it's the Walzes or Nancy Pelosi or whomever, that it's their ideas, it's their thoughts, it's where they want or how they want a speech to be written and delivered, but you are the vessel, if you will, or letting that speech come alive, letting it, you know, breathe, letting it be what it is, and you're complementing their vision of how that speech should be written. I always thought that when it came to speech writing, that although, and this was just my interpretation before we spoke or that we're speaking right now, I always thought that maybe there was, I don't know, maybe 80-20 or 70-30, where if you become a seasoned, you know, speech writer, that, you know, more or less over time, that you'll have more ownership. And I'm glad, just for my audience and me, that you corrected me and said it wasn't about ownership, because you're an extension. So I learned something today. I hope my audience learns it too, because when you're hearing speeches, you know, when I was an intern and I did hear speeches many years ago, that was when I was in my early 20s. So I really didn't think much about, even with a journalism degree from a top journalism school in the world, the UNC Husband School of Journalism and Media, again, I never really thought about the inner workings of speeches and speech writing. And, you know, my courses in college, although they were writing based, broadcast media based, and I do have a political journalism certificate as well, speech writing, I can't recall if there was a specific course that I took in college that had to do with speech writing. But just talking today, it's very fascinating how your career has evolved, and that it's wonderful that you get to work with a team at Fenway who have, like you, people who have been in these positions before, where they've worked at the White House or they've worked on campaigns for senators or congressmen or congresswomen, so, or governors. So I find that all remarkable.
Well, and to the theme of your podcast, yeah, about relationships in the workplace, and I would take it a step further and say relationships in the work product, right? That one of the things that I love so much about Fenway is that our strength is our relationships, right, to each other. So all of us, like you said, have come from speech writing backgrounds. So folks who've written for Presidents Obama and Biden, folks like me who've written for the Speaker, folks who've written for governors and senators and tech titans and CEOs and major philanthropists, you know, names that you read about in the newspaper every day. We all sort of have that same understanding about speech writing, right? In that fundamental approach, right? That it is collaborative, that it's creative, that it's best in a partnership dynamic. And we bring all that expertise to the table with everything that we do. So, for example, if I'm on a client, everything that I write for that client goes through review by everyone on our 12-person team, and everyone has that same approach to that piece with the same sort of speechwriting mindset and goes in and makes it even stronger. So I get edited by, some of the greatest speechwriters alive every day, and I absolutely love it because it makes me a better speechwriter, but more importantly, it gets our clients a better product. And a lot of times you'll go to a speechwriting firm and, they'll have their junior staff write something for you and the partner will slap their name on it and it'll get shipped out the door. But we don't have any junior staff. We are all, a team of more or less equals, though we have partners who call the shots. But when it comes to it, like I can edit a partner's thing just as much as they can edit my thing. And we're all working together to make every piece stronger. And it's that team dynamic that I think gives us such a great advantage in the marketplace and is what makes our work stand out. And it's something that I never got to experience in a political environment, right? Because we were talking before in the speaker's office, there were only ever two of us. And sure, there was a communications director and a press secretary and digital people and researchers and policy people and all that, but they're looking at these speeches in a very different way, right? Like the policy person is saying, is this line, correct in describing whatever political or policy proposal we have? The press person is this line going to be the best pull quote for the newspaper, right? And your researchers are, is this true? Is this accurate? Is this fair? When there was only one other speechwriter looking at this document saying, does this read like a speech, right? Does it tell a story? Does it make an argument? Is it persuasive? Is it compelling? Is it mobilizing, right? To your point, does it have a call to action? Now I'm in a group where 12 people rather than just one are looking at, the things I'm writing with that same speechwriter's mindset to say, is this a kick-ass speech? And it's just so exciting, the new dynamic that we're in, and I think just sums up the spirit of your podcast here about the leverage you get, the compounding power of well-built teams in producing great work.
Yes, and this is the Relationship Building in a Team Environment podcast, and really appreciate speaking with Aaron Bennett at Fenway. Worked with Nancy Pelosi, worked with the Wallses, a top speech writer, has an amazing career, and just love speaking with you about relationship building and team environment because in your profession, within the political realm in the United States, having worked in various capacities, working with different politicians, it is very interesting to me that yes, when it comes to building relationships, putting speeches together, and you mention a group of 12, including you, yeah, everybody may be his or her own individual, but when it comes to putting a speech together, 12 people, but a voice of one. And everybody has, as you point out, that mindset, or you talk about leverage where you're able to compound all of that, I want to say, like, horsepower of, ideas and knowing what the vision is going to look like when drafting a speech, and depending on who you're working with and understanding how they think and what drives them and, what their purpose is to find the best speech writers like you and others whom you work with, and to be able to make sure that everybody's on the same page and that everybody's ideas are heard.
It's the same sort of concept as like the relationship with the principal in that collab. You're talking before about how that is a collaborative process, and the same extends to a team of writers, a good team of writers like we've built here. You're in a mind meld, right? And while you all bring your own ideas and flavors and expertise to a speech, you all just get it, right? And it's so special to be in an environment where you just get it. And that's the same sort of success you're looking for when you're working directly with a principal. You want to be in sync in that same way where your ideas are flowing and you can't tell, is that my word? Is that Speaker Pelosi's word? Right? It's all one. It's all the same.
Right, you're learning how to deliver a speech where if it's not Speaker Pelosi and you're writing it or someone else is helping her write it, but really it's still her words, it's still her thoughts. She's drafting it and really counseling you all like what she hopes to accomplish in that speech, but that you couldn't tell the difference of whom it is. You're identifying it as a, oh, that is the type of speech that Speaker Pelosi would deliver. But then again, it's the people. The relationship building is so critical because she has to trust you all. And, she relies on you all to make sure that you are putting together a speech with her counsel or the people that she surrounds you all with, in the sense of it has to be a speech that if she were to work alone and not have that support, she's going to deliver that speech because it's Nancy Pelosi. So if she's going to have people around her, people she trusts, people that she's built relationships with over the years, they have to bolster, you know, that expectation that she has set. And that's such a relationship building tool that I would imagine with speech writing is that, you know, again, you are the tool in a sense, because like you said earlier, you're an extension of her ideas and her thoughts and, you know, her plan of how she wants to put that speech forward. So it's that extension of relationship building in a team environment, in an environment of speech writing, and again, delivering the messages that really help navigate and shape a campaign, a White House, positions on whatever policy that is being discussed.
And you're getting at what I think is why I love speechwriting so much. And I'll give it a brief defense here, because we're in a moment when everyone thinks the AI, you know, bubble is going to take over everything that we do. And people are doing podcasts and speaking off the cuff, and all that is fantastic. And they're great communications tools to have in our arsenal. But where I keep coming back to is the importance of the speech, right? And this fits right in line with the themes of your podcast, which a speech is the most basic fundamental tool for relationship building, or I always call it like human connection, right? That there is, because it's a person standing in front of another person or a group of people trying to explain an idea, to mobilize them to action, to inspire them with a vision of the future, to persuade them to join their side. It is the oldest form of communication that we have, going back thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of years. And it's at the atomic level of what all other communications are, right? Like, you go on social media, right? And you have a bite-sized version of what a speech can do, right? You're trying to talk and persuade and mobilize another person through a screen, right? But the human-to-human interface is just so fundamental, and it's built on that connection. It's the same thing with speech writing, right? It takes a human-to-human dynamic to craft something that sounds like a human, right? And that can speak to and connect with other humans, right? And that's why I think speech writing will always have a place, and speeches will always have a place in our modern communications environment. No, they don't have to be, we don't have to go back to the days where everything is a 45-minute speech. I don't think we should do that. That's a terrible idea. But I also don't think that we should never stand in front of a crowd and be forced to explain our ideas. I'm still in the camp that words matter, especially if you are an elected leader or, you know, the chairman of a company, right? You have some sort of fiduciary duty to be accurate and truthful and effective in your messaging. Same thing politically, right? You have constituents who rely on you to tell them what you believe and to then follow up and make good on those promises, to give them something to hope for and to dream about. So I still think that there will be a place for speeches in the world, and look no further than, you know, the state of things today, right? People are still out there speaking. You know, you see leaders like Bernie Sanders and AOC and Tim Walz going out and giving big rallies, speeches at crowds, right, to bring people together and to connect in opposition to what this administration is doing, right? You still have shareholders that get regular meetings and speeches from their CEOs, right? You still have governors like Gavin Newsom, when there's an emergency, they get in front of a microphone and they offer prepared remarks. It is still one of the better tools in the toolkit, and I think one of the best at actually connecting face to face and with someone. And then it's a type of speech that can travel, you know, across mediums, right? Like, you can't have an ad and then play it for someone in person, right? Like, that is just so singular platform. A speech, you have to talk to the people in the room, but you're also talking through a TV screen to viewers at home. You're also talking through a social media feed, through clips that people are going to see online. You're talking on paid advertising if they want to chop it up and put money behind it. It is still at the core of everything, at least in a political context, that we do in communications. You could put the words on a piece of paper and call it a press release, right? You were talking about before. It's still the atom on which effective communications is built, and that's why I love it so much.
Well, I'm glad you love it. And you mentioned Governor Gavin Newsom, and I believe that he'll be the front runner for the Democratic Party. I believe he will become the next president of the United States. And I may be bullish on that, but you know, he reminds me a lot like Presidents Obama and Biden, because he has looked up to President Biden and you know, somebody who can articulate so well, Governor Newsom, and someone who is very direct, and somebody who, again, he so quick on his feet, he really commands the attention of the room, whomever he's speaking with, and he's really been put in these prime time situations, whether it's when he had to debate, you know, Governor DeSantis, or what happened in California with the fires in the Pacific Palisades and Malibu and Altadena, and then when the National Guard that President Trump, you know, had federalized, not even allowing Gavin Newsom to speak about it, or just bypassing his administration to have the California National Guard come in, which Governor Newsom, you know, looked at it as like an invasion of his state. So it really changed the dynamic, the political landscape. And I believe going into the midterms next year, there will be a blue wave. And I believe that there's going to be a changing of a guard again in terms of which party's in power. Real quick, what speeches are you most prideful of? You know, which ones were the most difficult to write, or maybe some of the ones that were the easiest to write? And I did want to briefly extend my thoughts and prayers because I know that you're in Minnesota near the Twin Cities, and the mass shooting happened last week at the Catholic school in Minneapolis. And, you know, talk about speeches, really off-the-cuff speech, I would imagine, with the mayor of Minneapolis talking about it's not just about thoughts and prayers, although very important, you know, because especially a Catholic school that's going to be, you know, under siege and innocently targeted, and the mass violence and having two children murdered and having other adults and children injured while they're praying in the pews in a Catholic church. And for that to happen, my heart goes out to the communities that you're involved in, that you're a part of, because it's happened here in Florida. We've seen it happen in Connecticut. We've seen it happen in Colorado. You know, we've seen it happen just in other parts of the country. So from a speech writing perspective, I would imagine it's hard to write speeches when it comes to how grave the situation is. And you know, we have to really thank President Biden for, and you and I talked about this offline, Aaron, about the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act and the work that you did with Nancy Pelosi, how in the House you all had some really strong points about how you wanted a piece of legislation to come forward and to really, you know, become law, and what was included in the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act that eventually did pass, that President Biden signed. It was the strictest gun reform safety bill in nearly 30 years, going back to the assault weapons ban from 1994 to 2004.
Yeah, I think you summed up the state of the debate perfectly. And what all I'd say is that not every problem is a communications problem. Sometimes it's an action problem, a policy problem. And the most effective speeches actually say something. So thoughts and prayers don't cut it. You actually need to march to your point before. You have to have a plan of action. You have to do something. And we've made great strides in this country. But if you have an idea on how we can actually get this done, like, we'll help you write that speech because this is too big, high stakes of an issue. You know, no more kids need to get murdered for us to finally get this thing done. So say something, not just thoughts and prayers. That's my advice to anyone writing speeches on in these horrible moments. Say something. And then to answer your other question, we have something called the Speechwriters Code, which means we can't talk about specific projects that we worked on because the ownership, like we were talking about before, belongs to the principal. So I can't talk in detail about any speeches that I may or may not have contributed to, but there are speeches that come to mind that taught me lessons. And the one I'll briefly share is the speaker was doing this big keynote event speech, and it was one of the few that we actually were going to work on for weeks and weeks in advance rather than just, you know, like I said, crashing on right before. And I'd struggled for days and days to write something, just total writer's block, had no ideas. Finally put together a crappy draft, brought it into her, and said, "Ma'am, this isn't very good, but hopefully it's a start. I just truly didn't know what I wanted to say in this speech." And she turns to me and says, "Good. Good thing I know what I want to say." And that was a moment that really unlocked for me, like we were talking about before, these aren't my speeches, right? They're collaborative. And your goal is always in service of helping the principal be successful. And sometimes it starts with listening to them, as simple as it may seem. But they are there. These great people get to these positions of great power and influence because they have a lot of talent and a lot of skill. And our job is just to help them shine. So I'll leave it there. But thanks again for having me on. This has been wonderful.
Yes, Aaron Bennett, my 81st guest on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. Thank you so much for your time today. Really learned a lot. I know it was wonderful for my audience and me to hear about days in the life of Aaron Bennett, one of the top speechwriters, up and coming, I should say, but really have been blazing trails in the Democratic Party, and you know, working with Nancy Pelosi, working with Governor and First Lady Walz. And it's truly remarkable to have you on. It's a pleasure speaking with you. I wish you all the best in your career with continued success. And I look forward to staying in touch and having many more conversations in the future. Thank you so much for your time again.
Awesome. Thanks, Garrett. Take it easy.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too.